So if we look on the schedule now, we are at Life as a Physicist, the last session for today. This is a really fantastic session. This is an opportunity for you guys to talk to scientists, physicists, about what life as a physicist is like. So the general idea here is, if you're thinking about going into science, any of the sciences or physics in particular, you know, what kind of questions would you have if you ran into a scientist? You know, have you, what was your trajectory through you know, education, career? How did that work? What were you like as a student? All that kind of stuff. You know, how do you pick universities? Whatever, all kinds of questions you might have for them. So most of the talks here at ISSYP focus on physics. But this is a very special session where we try to focus more on the human side of science. So what's involved in terms of sort of getting into science and all that. So I'm very pleased that we have with us today Natalia and Philip. And Natalia, you've seen this morning, gave the keynote on physics. So both Natalia and Philip are particle physicists, and they have a finger in both the experimental and theoretical side, which is really nice. And I've asked you guys to think a little bit about some questions, and these two people are very kind, and they would love to hear questions, and they'd love to try to answer your questions. So just fire away, and we'll let it go. So let's give Natalia and Philip a warm welcome.
How certain were you of your ability to find work after your undergrad, and when did you first feel secure in your position in physics?
So the answer to the first part is easy for me, no. I mean, I think I was, there's obviously a lot of stages to an academic career, and just when you feel comfortable with one stage, like you've got it under control, you're doing it pretty well, you move on to the next one. And that's just the nature of it. It's a little intimidating. It was very intimidating for me as a high school kid. I was like, really? You know, physics seems like a lot of fun, but could I do it? You know, and there are a lot of myths out there about the sort of genius physicists that I think make it that much harder if the science you're interested in is physics, that you think, you know, either you're Einstein and you have flashes of genius, or, you know, you're nothing. Which isn't true at all, okay? Just like all other sciences, it's a lot of hard work. A lot of thinking, really understanding stuff, asking lots of questions, and moving on. So it was intimidating for me. But I think the insecurity, which I still feel, by the way, I think most physicists still feel it, not just about career, but about, you know, am I actually achieving something worthwhile? You can't get over it, but you can harness it. You can turn it into something that keeps you focused on trying to do the best, you know, trying to make sure that you're always doing things that where the result will matter, at least to you intellectually, to the broader community, you know, help you understand something that you really want to understand, and focus on, you know, important problems by whatever metric of importance matters the most to you, whether it's intellectual or having real-world applications, etc. Anything to add, Philip?
Yeah, I'm not sure you're supposed to feel secure at that point. I certainly would not. I think a lot of physicists, even after they've been in the field for a long time, you know, they don't necessarily feel, maybe they feel secure in their job, but they don't necessarily feel secure in what they're doing. And I think that's just part of the science. It's not always clear that what you're doing is going to pan out. Fact is, most of what we do doesn't pan out. You just hope to learn a little bit in the process. And occasionally you make a big breakthrough. So there's a lot of insecurity that has nothing to do with the job, it has to do with the science. As far as the job goes, though, there's lots of interesting things to do in the world. You know, so physics didn't pan out, I'd be doing something else. I'm sure that's true.
I have a question probably more for Natalia than for you, but you could probably give your opinion on it too. Do you find that, like, you can see half of us are girls here, but do you find that there's any double standards still in physics prior to sexism or anything?
So, I think there's subtle things in physics in the same way that there are in other fields. I think I'm very lucky that I haven't experienced any direct overt sexism that impacted me. I think that's becoming a lot less common with time. But there are still, I mean, all the things, if you read the studies that social scientists do about this stuff, you know, given a person with the same qualifications, a man or a woman, people will read and write recommendation letters differently. And physics is very much a field where letters and sort of personal reputation matter a lot to what you do next. So I think, you know, that is inevitably still an issue. And it's also true, you know, I am so happy to see so many young women in this room compared to what I usually see at an academic conference, which is, you know, maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 5 or 1 in 20, depending on the field. So I don't know what to say. It's getting a lot better with time, as far as I can tell. There's a lot of supportive people out there, men and women, who actually, you know, want to make the effort to make sure that women who are really good do really well, and the men who are really good do really well, and who just don't care. Just don't care about gender, or care, but they do care about helping people who have talent succeed and nurture that talent.
I'm going to be, you know, heading to college next year, so I was wondering what opportunities you guys were able to find to pursue physics at the undergraduate level.
You want to start, Paul?
In my case, there were a lot of research programs that I would do, and there was a winter break and a summer break. And there was an undergraduate research opportunities program. I got involved in that very early on, and I recommend doing that wherever you go. I think a lot of universities have programs like that in one form or another. And the reason it's valuable is you get a very clear sense early on that there's a very, very sharp difference between what and how you learn things in the classroom and what and how you learn things when you're doing research of any kind. In some cases, they're similar, but they really are rather different. And it's important to, of course, learn things formally, and it really requires sitting down and doing that with structure. But it's good to be made aware early on of what it takes to kind of stay afloat with research.
Did either of you do the CERN summer school when you were undergrad?
Not the CERN summer school. I did a couple or one or two other REUs, and I did a lot of, at my own university, I did quite a bit of research projects there. I actually faxed in, this was back before they accepted email applications, I actually faxed in my CERN summer school application upside down, emailed them like 2 days after the deadline to ask if I could resubmit it, and they said no. So. I was pretty crushed by that, but I had a good summer research that year anyway. Just one thing I'd add to Philip's answer is I'd second him that getting involved in some research projects is really useful. It gives you a sense of what life as a physicist is like, and it helps you learn how to learn things for research, which is really different from just learning things, you know, obviously, when you're in a class, you want to really understand the stuff. But you're not tested on whether you understand the stuff in the same way that, you know, you're tested on whether you can solve the test problems, right? And I think the other piece of advice that I'd give, which I didn't really take to heart as a college student, was really take the opportunity in your classes to understand stuff really well. Because I think much more than other subjects, much more than you realize in high school or early in college, every physics class that you take will build on the other ones. And the better you understand each set of concepts, the more you can internalize it, make it your own, really understand it in your own way, and be just have a great facility with it, the more it'll help you as you go on. And also the more it'll help you have a solid footing for your research down the road if you stay in physics. So, it's something, especially for people who want to continue in research. I'd say as important as doing research is and balances everything out, also, you know, never take the stuff that you're learning in your classes for granted. Like, if you can do the tests easily and the problem sets easily and you've got that, and you want to move on to something more fun, great. But also take the time to go back and really make sure that you've thought about every possible angle on it. No thanks, cold. It's incredibly valuable. Yeah.
Going into theoretical physics, was there ever a time where you were considering a different career path in like a different scientific field? And then what swayed you going to theoretical physics specifically?
Let's see. So I wanted to be an engineer for most of my childhood. I just sort of meandered into physics as, I read a lot of books about the early history of quantum mechanics, and they, convinced me that actually there are a lot of wrong turns and confusions and smart but not fantastically genius people that make a lot of progress in physics, and that, maybe I stood a chance. And I always found it just really exciting, so I was sort of driven to it. It was that barrier of fear that kept me away for a long time. So then I studied physics in college, and I really like this stuff. Of course I want to go to grad school. Then my second year of grad school, I was like, and my advisor still kind of makes fun of me for this, by the way. I was like, man, do I really want to do this? And I mean, it bothered me at that point that it had no, that the kind of physics I was doing had no direct applications to everyday life and to benefit of humanity and all that good stuff. So I thought seriously about quitting and doing something else. And for me, I just decided evaluated my own values and that, for me, making intellectual contributions was enough if I could do it. And so I decided I'd give physics another try. That's actually the way I look at it all the time, is, right now I'm giving physics a try as a career. And I hope I'm still saying that in 20, 30 years too, that I'm gonna try to make some progress, and if I feel like I'm not doing anything in this field, I should leave, I should find something else to do. This is a field where I'm constantly learning something new and trying to understand different things every day, even without changing fields. So changing fields and having to do that wouldn't be that big of a change. Anything bad?
Well, just going back to the end of your question, yeah, I wanted to build planes as an engineer, basically. I would still do that. I mean, I could quit now and do that, I think I'd be happy. But at some point, I think actually the thing that got me into physics, for some reason, I didn't even really realize that physics as a field even existed up until relatively late. I mean, I had never even really heard of theoretical physics. And actually, it was the book by Hawking, Brief History of Time. I got this book at some point as a gift, and I read it, and it made me aware that this field even existed. And so that kind of started a bit of an obsession with time. I started out in math, probably because I thought that was what you were supposed to do if you were going to do physics, and then I switched over to physics formally. I'm not sure that theoretical physics should be thought of as a career the way that you would ordinarily think of a career. I think if you're thinking of it as a career, you probably shouldn't go into it. No, I don't mean that, obviously, but it is a very different sort of, let's just say you got to really, it's the sort of thing where most of your, and I'll just be very honest with you, most of what you do is a constant struggle. And if you ask anybody, it's just a constant struggle. And every once in a while you'll be sort of a moment where things really crystallize and you understand the world, in a way that nobody else has, and then you spend time communicating that and then you build on it. And of course, in the back of your mind, you really hope that that will either turn into something that can really be put to good use someday, and that certainly happened. I mean, we all know the examples of that. But oftentimes it doesn't feel that way. So then the next best thing is to hope that you really can confirm your ideas with experiment. So that's part of the reason that I try to kind of keep one foot in experiment and one foot in theory, was just to kind of keep myself grounded. But I'll leave it at that.
Going back to the question before this one, the one where you mentioned about why, where you mentioned that you chose physics over engineering. Yeah, I was wondering whether, let's say, you had the opportunity to go back in time, would you have still chosen physics over engineering? As in, whether...
I think so. I mean...
They're very different. I mean, as a physicist, you, well, okay, I mean, in a way, in both fields, you build things, one way or another. In theoretical physics, you are building, some people would say you're discovering, I tend to think of it more as building. You're building a mathematical model of the universe that you can use. In engineering, you're building something more direct. But they're both in many ways very similar.
No, I think that's true.
You said that your job is a constant struggle where you have to like think about everything. So what is your day like? Like, what is your day kind of like?
So it depends on the day, because I mean, both of us do a whole lot of different things that involve very different activities, very different struggles. So let's see. I think running an experiment, which we both did together, is probably a lot like being here. You just have to be on for like 21 hours every day, and things go wrong if you don't. And it was, you know, a lot of, that involved a lot of like talking to people, thinking about like, oh, there's this little problem, how do we solve it? Also running forms from one building to another and having to get other people to take me into the buildings because I didn't have an access card. But
running an experiment was...
I'm not adequately doing justice to how much fun it was.
That was a struggle, but that was the most fun I've ever had. Oh. I mean, that was just awesome. It was 2 weeks of not sleeping, but the end result was some data that we could use. Both of us worked on this experiment at the Jefferson Lab. But the end result was well worth it. So that was
and it was, you know, it was really like solve, you know, how do I do this problem? And you get the immediate returns that now that you've solved it, you can have beam hit your target and start looking at what happens. And we knew we were analyzing, we were taking good data that could be analyzed later. So these days we're both working also together on we do a lot of work together, which is fun. We're working on something much more theoretical, where basically we come in, we're like, this is the problem I should think about, and I start calculating in my notebook, and usually get all confused and decide, no, that's not a problem I can solve right now, look for a different thing that I can try to calculate, think about that, look at some reference books, you know, it's
but The problem is
talk to each other.
This is something more general thing, but I mean the usual problem with theoretical physics is that most of the problem, I mean, there's usually lots of questions about the way that fundamental forces can fit together, the way they do fit together, where they come from, how they work, different ways of describing them, making predictions for different phenomena. I mean, there's a laundry list of things that theorists do. The usual problem is that most of those things nobody has any idea how to solve. And I mean, literally, just maybe they have an idea, but they just can't calculate anything, and all they can do is speculate. The really hard part about theoretical physics that we spend a lot of time debating, discussing, and that frankly, I mean, you were sort of saying, sort of every day starts with, well, what can I actually solve? And you might have some broader set of problems you're after, but you kind of have to find sort of like footholds, sort of one small calculation you can do that teaches you something, and then you do two or three of those, and then you build on them. So of course, there's a lot of math in we calculate things a lot, and recalculate things, and rewrite things, and try to understand what's going on. But it feels like a very incremental process most of the time. And then every once in a while, it'll be like everything will fit together and we'll, you know, it feels like we're making a big leap. But it, for a lot of the time, it just feels like it's really incremental. And that was kind of the struggle I was referring to, is that if you're not prepared to work really, really, really hard, not knowing that things are going to pan out, then you're going to have a tough time.
Yeah, and some days it'll be like, wow, I have figured out nothing today. That sucks, or do I suck? And then sometimes I basically figured out only a, you know, only a couple of really small things this month. They might be wrong. I'm really stuck. But then all that work eventually, you know, a month later, it crystallizes into, you know, you're like, oh, so that's how. And it, I mean, the line between the problems that are already solved and the problems that we just have no idea how to solve, at least definitively, right? That little band in between is actually, in some respects, fairly narrow. That's where we have to work, right? And we're trying to carve out other regions of problems that we can solve, sort of map away into the dark half of physics. So.
But on a day-to-day basis, there's lots and lots of talking. Sort of back and forth between talking, calculating, and maybe it's just me, but my strategy for doing physics is to make every single mistake I can possibly make, and then I'll eventually get the right answer. So for me, at least, it's just figuring out what I did wrong most of the time. But yeah, it's a lot of back and forth. But
yeah, and also, I mean, depending on what kinds of problems you're interested in, a lot of computer work too. There have been times when the work that I did was mostly computer programming, debugging, look at the results, force myself to get away from the code for long enough to think about the big picture, and then go back to the code again. So the sort of day-to-day, you know, whether it's running an experiment, working with computer software, writing computer programs, just thinking in a notebook, you know, it varies. But I think the going from one failure to the next with undiminished enthusiasm is a common feature of all of them.
If you had to choose between, if you had to go from having a foot in both theoretical and experimental physics to only choosing one of them, which one would you choose and why?
Yeah, I don't know
the answers. Yeah. No, I mean, at a practical level for me, I mean, I was trained as a theoretical physicist and discovered my sort of strong passion for experiment as I went along. So I don't have the tools to be a good full-time experimental physicist. So for that reason, I'd probably choose theory. On the other hand, but that's a cop-out answer, because that's just like what's easier for me. I think ultimately experimental physics is a much more definitive process, a much more definitive part of the science. Actually, I mean, in a sense, a lot more instrumental to our progress. On the other hand, that's kind of a short-sighted view. I often feel that way, but it's a bit short-sighted because there could be experiments out there that yield heaps of progress that we aren't going to think up unless we think about theory first. I guess I'm answering the other question, why do I value having a foot in both rather than actually choosing?
Yeah, I think times have changed a little bit. I think 50 years ago, the answer, or certainly 100 years ago, the answer was pretty unambiguous to the experiment. It was much more important, and I certainly would have been an experimentalist. And frankly, a lot of experimentalists were theorists at the same time. Most of the people you've heard of, certainly in the 1920s or so, I mean, they did experiments at the same time. I mean, Dirac, who's sort of famously thought of as one of the most mathematical physicists ever, also did experiments. Not all the time, for sure. I mean,
he did a couple.
Thomson was sort of both discovered the electron and was trying to be a theorist. I mean, it was much more common back then. But what's happened now is we have a much more complete picture of the world. So, of course, you can't just go off and do experiments and expect to learn a lot. It's much more of a process now where I would say being a good experimentalist requires kind of knowing where to look. So that's why I think increasingly at the same time, it's very hard to do experiments. You kind of do have to pick and choose. If you want to do a meaningful experiment, you have to invest a lot of time. But at the same time, if you do it in isolation, you're probably not going to make an isolation of theory. I think the odds of making a substantial breakthroughs are small. That's why I don't want to separate.
Either you.
I want to go back to this question. I had a similar question, like, how does your day look like, or how does your week look like? Do you have some fixed schedule? Do you get weekends off, or does it depend on the amount of work you have, or whatever project you are working on? Like, how does it look like?
Yeah, it varies a lot. So I mean, and for with very few exceptions, it's all a matter of, you know, self-motivation, working really long hours because you want to find the answer to something or you want to finish something quickly. But I mean, you know, days vary from 8 hours to 19. Usually not 19 for me. I can't do that for more than 1 or 2 days at a time. I used to, but not anymore.
But when we ran the experiment, those were like 19-hour days for 2 weeks straight, and I didn't think that would be possible, but it is. So it can be like that. But usually, you know, it varies from 4-hour days to 12-hour days, and it fluctuates.
So this goes back to what you guys were discussing before, but obviously working in theoretical physics, not all of the time your theories are able to be, you know, tested. So how do you feel working with theories that you can't prove experimentally? You just have to trust the math and urge, you know.
So, yeah, go ahead. Well, okay, I really don't like working with theories that I know can't be tested for that reason. There was a time when, and I'll just pick on string theory for me personally, as I was taking a string theory class in grad school, there was a time when I got very, you know, excited about the mathematics. And I was really enjoying being able to calculate various things, and they were about black hole solutions in 5 or 6 dimensions, something like that. And I was like, and then one day I'm like, but, you know, this is just math to me. We don't, you know, how do we know whether these are relevant to the real world? Now, there's another class of things, and a lot of things fall into this class, where you can't tell whether it's going to be. Well, there's two other classes of things. One is where you have to work out the theory to a large extent. You have to make sense of it before you know whether it's testable or not. That's very easy for me to do because, well, you know, the ultimate goal is still the same, having a testable theory. And then there's a lot of work that's a matter of just trying to understand the theory better. So a theory's been tested, we think it's right, but maybe there's a different way of thinking about it. And that is also, I think, very purely theoretical, but important because you know, who knows what it'll suggest, who knows how it'll change our understanding, and there is a solid way.
I mean, my personal feeling about this, I sort of kind of flattened the wind a little bit. I mean, at some level, part of physics is very personal. Part of it is just about trying to understand the world for yourself, and who cares if your theory can't be tested in your lifetime? It's you're just trying to understand things in a language that feels right. And then there's another part where you're trying to see if pieces of that do relate to the real world, which I think that's the part that's actually important with the progress of the science. I think if everybody in the field all the time drifted to the part that I just mentioned, we would very quickly kind of grind to a halt. So I sort of see why that part's important. It's important to me, I think it's important to a lot of people. Because part of this is just about understanding the world. And we can't be so short-sighted that we're only think about things that we can test within a decade. That's never worked in the past, and it's certainly not going to work now. But I do think it's a lot of us. And it's really actually rather hard to find the places where the ideas that we're playing with can actually be tested with experiment. But when you do find them, it's very, very satisfying. I mean, the experiment that we got involved in was actually largely motivated by kind of this explosion of activity that had to do with some findings from satellite experiments that had to do with dark matter. And a number of us were thinking about classes of theories that people had been talking about for 3 decades, but just didn't seem like you should go off and really test them. It wasn't quite clear how you would test them or why you would test them. But then it became very clear that actually there were a set of experiments to do to test them, and that was just enormously exciting. That doesn't happen that often. That's pretty rare. So we're all kind of on the lookout for things like that.
Do you find it difficult to like disconnect as soon as you get home and eventually return to your social life? Like, are you still thinking about your research?
So, I know we'll have different answers for this one. I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing it when I want to, and it, you know, chugging along when I want to, continuing to think about it.
Yeah, I don't compartmentalize. Even if I'm pretending I'm not thinking about it, I think about it.
So going back to like choosing a problem to work on, how did you choose your topic for your thesis?
So in particle physics these days, people work on stuff that their advisors sort of recommend to work on, and sometimes some other stuff too. And then whatever they've worked on over the course of grad school, they call it a thesis. So that part is actually much less intimidating than I thought it would be going into grad school. Because, you know, you pick projects to learn about, to work on, and then eventually you just call something a thesis. That's the easy part. Picking what problems to work on, though, in general, as grad students, was tough for me. Advisors help a lot with that. They shoot lots of problems at you, and part of the good thing about that is, hey, somebody else is coming up with problems. The other good part is that you get to, you know, try them on and figure out which of them are, you know, what's the difference between a well-posed problem and a badly posed problem? Or problems that are well-posed but just not your thing. So you get exposure to a lot of different kinds of problems, figure out what you work on well, what you work on less well, and as you dig into it, you know, often have it takes time, but you start having ideas for projects of your own. A good advisor is really key to that process. I mean, I don't think anybody can, I know some people can, but I think it's very unusual for people to be able to start doing physics research, just, you know, themselves, come up with a great problem, you know, just because they were so inspired by their last class, or by some article they read in Scientific American, I mean that, or by an article you read in a journal even. For most people, there's a real building up time where none of those things can be turned, you don't know how to turn any of those things very effectively into a research problem. Because it's not easy, you just learn how to do it.
I mean, this is probably, I'm actually not sure how far beyond physics this carries. I know in other fields, I think in other fields actually a lot of thesis topics require a heck of a lot of work to put together. In theoretical physics, a lot of projects are short. They're sort of 6 months to a year. So you'll do two or three of them in the span of a graduate career. And then that'll be packaged into a thesis. And sort of just echoing the thought, if you decide to go into graduate school in physics, especially if it's on the theoretical side, you'll know you're doing the right thing if you're jumping from one, if you don't get hung up on kind of bad problems. You have to tackle bad problems, see what you can do, try things on for size. You'll learn a lot of things in the process, but if you're not getting sort of if you're not being exposed to diversity, that's probably not a good thing.
At least in
theoretical physics. That's not true in experiments, for example.
So, how is the social life as a physicist?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, that can mean many things. I mean, it's
like someone must have a social life. Like, what do you do when you, like, do you ever get the free time?
Well, I mean, yes, we get. I mean, in principle, we actually have a lot of free time. But I will actually say, I mean, and you know, and of course, we do things, you know, various things outside of work. But I have to say, at least speaking for myself, but maybe you have this to some extent as well. We actually really like what we do. So in many ways, it doesn't feel like a job. It actually feels like a fun thing to do in your free time anyway. Not all the time, but it ends up kind of, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun for its own sake. I maybe more than Philip still feel like I need to change gears and do something else for some part of the day. Otherwise, I just, you know, it's not that I don't love what I do, it's that I don't want to feel that narrowly single-minded. I feel healthier when I'm doing a couple of other things with my life too. So there's time for that. I mean, Are you asking more about like outside work? Because that's very individual and not related to physics, I think. Or are you asking about like the social life within, you know, the social component of being an adulting like PI with a bunch of other physicists?
Yeah, being an adulting like PI.
Well, being a physicist is a very social thing. We talk to each other a lot. It's that, I mean, in many ways, you can almost get carried away. You can almost spend too much time talking, but so that part is certainly there. But
yeah, but it's weird because everybody has their head in a problem. So often the you know, like we all get together at lunch and talk about, you know, what papers we read the other day or what or you know, some detail of some calculation that we're doing that we're working with somebody else on. And I remember when I was early on in grad school, I started going to lunch with the particle physics group, and I just hated it. I was like, why do these people not talk about other things? and I mean, it, I don't know if I was broken or if I just got used to it, got into it, got on the inside of that circle more over time. I think the latter. But I mean, so it's a very sort of, it's very social in a very, very focused way that I certainly wasn't used to before. That all you talk to other people about is in the building, the most part is your research. At least among the researchers. You know, very rarely do I like find out how other faculty kids are doing or what they did for vacation, or I'm more likely to find that out from the admin staff while I'm getting coffee. So, but it's part of the culture. You see another physicist, you talk to them about what you're working on. It's very
Does working in theoretical physics ever get too overwhelming? Like, I'm sure in working in string theory, trying to solve problems in like 11 dimensions might just be, you know, too hard to comprehend. Does it ever just get too overwhelming working in situations like that?
Well, I mean, you were talking about like following the math earlier. Last time you asked a question. I think you do have to do a lot of that, even with the basic stuff. Like if you're talking about just particle physics, there's so much that I have no intuition for why it happens or, you know, how the quantum mechanics works. I just, you know, I can do the calculation. I know that it gets the right answer out. I don't know why, like, I know mathematically why it's the right calculation, but I don't know, you know, physically, because there is no intuition for that kind of thing. Our intuition is about, you know, big classical objects in a world where gravity is important and nothing else is except a little bit of electricity. So one has to just follow the math, see where it leads you, and make sure you don't make mistakes or make every mistake and then fix it, and just kind of keep track of where you're going.
I mean, going back to this, going back to this sort of social element. So theoretical physics is actually it's a fairly small world. I mean, after a while, it's like a small town in a way. Everybody kind of knows everybody else. And in that regard, it's a lot of fun. I mean, you definitely feel like you're part of a small community, and you're really working towards a common goal. And I think a great deal of camaraderie kind of, you know, develops with time. And I mean, this probably affects kind of our sense of what it even means to have a social life, because it, you know, after a while, it just becomes so much fun to just keep thinking about this stuff, keep chipping away at it. You know, and there's 6,000 people across the Atlantic working full time, trying to chip away at it too, and we all talk to each other at these regular conferences. And then every once in a while, every few years, it's been 15 since we had a significant discovery. You know, a major discovery is made, and it's hard to articulate that, you know, socially at least, that's tremendously fun. I mean, I'm sure, you know, everybody has sort of immediate friends or sets of friends. Kind of the theoretical physics community, we're kind of like it's a fairly tight-knit kind of group. I don't know if that's overdoing it, but
no, I think that's right. I mean, it's like, well, you know, you guys probably have like an alumni network that you'll keep in touch with each other from around the world after this. And being a particle physicist is a lot like being part of a big alumni network or something. Like when we get together at a conference, we're happy to see each other, you know, find out what's going on with the other person, work-wise and otherwise. I'll tell you, before this Higgs discovery announcement, we were actually visiting family. But we were also on Google Chat a whole lot of time with some of our physicist friends. Just talking about, oh, how are you going to watch the announcement? How are you going to watch the announcement?
What party are you going to?
Do you have a party at the department? Or so it becomes part of your social life in a way that I think is difficult to articulate, but probably most like sort of, you know. The closest analogy I can find is to like an alumni network. People who spend really intense time together, but not very often, and then go off and do their own thing. But keep following each other. Instead of checking each other's Facebook status, we're checking what the other person has posted on the archive and reading their papers if we think they're interesting.
As a theoretical physicist, with your network from around the world, is every person sitting on the brink of like suddenly solving a problem and becoming very famous, as they would say, in terms of enlightening other physicists? Or is it all like a big puzzle in which you're all fitting in different pieces until you come to this big conclusion that'll, in terms of revolutionize theoretical physics?
I think far more often than not, lots of little puzzles where different subgroups in this community are working on smaller problems that, you know, together chipping away and thinking, and you know, there's the hope that once you chip away at the problem enough, it will actually be important. And at least the idea will become famous, even if the individuals didn't, because there are so many people working on it. And there's lots of little problems like that. I mean, we're not all thinking about the same puzzles. Some of us are thinking about, like, you know, stuff that's tested at the LHC. A lot of people are thinking about dark matter. A lot of people are just trying to understand field theory better, just within what I would call particle physics. And I think it's healthy to spend some fraction of your time just trying to start something new. The reality is that most people probably don't try that hard at that. And even most of the people who do try, you'd never know, because most of the people who try don't actually succeed. And really, you know, having like the revolutionary idea that makes it famous. Some people have different tastes. Some people like to work on the more high risk but high payoff problems. Other people like to work on, you know, something where there's definitely a body of knowledge that they're contributing to. Whether it's a body of knowledge about the real world or about some speculative theory, we really can't know that until much later on. But I think there are both cultures in the field. I guess that's what I'm saying. You want to add to that?
No, I think everybody's constantly trying to evaluate their software for the field. I mean, not everybody's about to become famous.
Could you give it in any way? Could you like expand on and give an example? For example, what were you doing? Let's say just in the past week, like what kind of an idea were you working with people from where? I'm just trying to get an idea of like your ongoing study that is happening. How does it work with other people in your network? What do you guys work on?
Well, okay, so both of us are doing a number of things. I mean, one project that we're working on is on this experimental project. So our experimental facility we're working at is at Jefferson Lab. So we have roughly 100 people officially in our collaboration and 20 who really, really work at it, and like kind of a core group of about 7 or 8. And we're in pretty constant email contact. You know, we talk on Skype fairly often. You know, I talked yesterday with our co-spokespeople. We have a meeting tomorrow where we have to explain some of the technical aspects of our experiment to prepare for an upcoming run. So, I mean, there's a lot of regular meetings and conversations and exchanging information, and you know, sometimes, most of the time it's about physics, but, you know, oftentimes I'll call up Ruben, or Ruben will call up, you know, he's a colleague of mine, and we'll start the conversation with something totally unrelated, you know, about, you know, he's looking for a place to live or something like that, you know, and then it'll drift to physics, it'll drift to the experiment, it'll drift to what was being posted on the archive, and, you know, so there's that kind of stuff that goes on. Well, is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, so,
but then
yeah.
There's another project where just the two of us are working. And we're probably at one of these stages where we're not sure if it's going to pan out. But if it pans out, it'll really pan out.
Yeah, and I mean, most people, in theory, most people work in, at least in particle theory, in groups of like 2 to 5 on most problems. And, you know, talk to each other about it, decide, you know, have an idea, move forward developing that idea, put out a paper. And, you know, it's different groups of 2 to 5 on each project. But that's the sort of typical size. Often it's the people that work at the same place as you or with some people that were visiting or you were visiting them, so it gets started and then you finish it over a long distance. Experimental particle physics these days, I mean, the LHC collaborations each have like 3,000 people on them. And obviously analyses are done by smaller groups, but there's much more of a review process that brings together, say maybe not thousands of people groups, but like hundreds of people groups that are all reviewing each other's work, studying them, contributing to a sort of in a coordinated way to this common goal. In theory, I think, although there's obviously a lot of building on other people's contributions, disagreeing with them, revising things based on what other people say, it tends to be a lot less coordinated. So people coordinate in groups of 2 to 5, do their thing, post a paper to the archive, other people read it and do their own thing.
But like the typical way that a paper, like, I mean, if I just had to sort of map out kind of the guts of a paper, you know, it'll often start with some casual conversation over lunch, triggered by who knows what, or, you know, or just bumping into people. And then, you know, maybe nothing will happen for a month, and then they'll follow it up in another conversation, and then they'll, most of the collaborations just happen remotely anyway. And then, you know, and then they'll sort of write a paper and bounce it back and forth, and then it'll appear in the archive. And that's like a 3 or 4 months of a thing. And there's a lot of papers that are not big papers. They're not big ideas. They're kind of, it's more incremental progress on a problem that, broadly speaking, is important, but you know, the papers are sort of small things. Though that's kind of the typical mode. I think there's no like model for you also asked the question about, you know, are people sort of poised to become famous at various points with big things. I don't know if there's sort of a mode for that to happen. I think it happens rarely enough, but fairly differently.
Do you collaborate a lot with physicists from other fields as well?
Not really, but
yeah. Well, the one kind of collaboration that we've done, I mean, experimentalists and theorists are, you know, really viewed as, by many people as more different fields than different types of theorists. And we certainly bridge that divide on a somewhat regular basis.
But I mean, as a particle theorist, I have not collaborated, for example, with condensed matter theorists. You know, I might have more natural overlap with cosmologists here, for example. So I could easily imagine collaborating with cosmologists, and I do collaborate with experimentalists. But it's not like, I mean, you know, the subfields do kind of divide up a little bit. I mean, PI is a somewhat special place. I think a lot of collaborative work is in.
Does theoretical physics offer a promising and stable career, or would you recommend something more practical like engineering?
I think it has the potential to be promising. So stability-wise, you get a stable career in theoretical physics once you're a tenured professor. And how long it takes to get there, and what fraction of graduate students, I mean, the fraction of graduate students that get there is low. But as Philip was saying, there's lots of points along the way when you can really take your background and use it well. So I wouldn't be too scared by the small percentage of people that do become tenured professors. Just because there's a lot of other great paths you can take from your background. But there's a question of, how long are you willing to wait before you get into a stable career? Because it does take a while, and so that's a personal thing. you know, for me, the issue was, am I willing to, like, how does that correlate with having kids and not knowing whether, you know, if I don't get tenure, you know, do I want to have a little 1 or 2 year old at the time I find out I'm not getting tenure? Do I want to wait that long to have kids? That was the kind of question for me that I had to wrestle with as far as the timeline. And I'm lucky because for me, and it fluctuates with time, it fluctuates in different areas. For me as a particle physics theorist, at the time that I got into it, it's been a relatively short road. I mean, I got out of grad school 5 years ago, and I've been here for a year and a half. So, you know, and I'll be up for tenure in a couple of years. So that's not bad. In other fields where you have usually 10 to 15 years of postdocs, that uncertainty is a much, much bigger deal. As for rewarding, I think you'll learn quickly whether you find it rewarding or not. And if you find it rewarding, it's usually worth all the uncertainty. If you don't find it rewarding, you shouldn't be doing it because it's not financially lucrative enough to be worth doing for the money. It's, you know, not that we suffer financially, but it's, you know, it's not the get rich quick scheme either.
I mean, the sort of joke within physics, I mean, you know, people have sort of trickled, I mean, I know plenty of people who sort of trickle out of the field, you know, into finance or into other things. They make all the money. I mean, there's much more lucrative ways to make money if you have training as a physicist. The training can be put to good use anywhere you go, largely because physics, if I had to sort of summarize what you just learn to solve problems one way or another of all kinds, and that always comes in handy. I mean, just looking back on going through undergraduate, going through graduate school, at every stage, people were leaving the field, not because they weren't good at it. In fact, some of the absolute brightest people I've ever met who were starting out as physicists left the field to go do something totally different. And you know, some in finance, some in some other fields. So I think your question was about stability. Yeah, that, I think it takes a while.
On the other hand, I don't know that many stable careers out there in the world today that are really, you know, I mean, I say, you know, it's not stable until you have tenure, but tenure is much more stable than anything else out there. So.
Okay, somebody just.
Okay, do you find that where you study as an undergrad impacts the rest of your, I guess you could say, career as a physicist?
Should we be striving for Harvard or MIT?
I want to say no. I can say that statistically, the fraction of, you know, top 10 undergrad, like, if I look at the fraction of physicists that went to, you know, top 10 colleges, whatever, it's much higher than the fraction of the population that went to these.
But what is true?
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's definitely a strong correlation, but I don't think you should think that that means that there's actually a causal effect. That
yeah.
Because I mark my words, having been active in admissions groups now, and sort of being exposed to letters, if you're an undergrad trying to go to, first of all, as an undergrad, it doesn't matter really where. I mean, as long as you learn a lot, you show that you're very capable. Usually, the way it works is if you're coming from a school that's lesser known as a powerhouse of physics, when we're talking like physics as a concrete example, if one person really vouches for you, the admissions committees in good graduate schools will notice, okay? And that tends to be an equalizer.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm sure people slip through the cracks, but that tends to be an equalizer. It does take somebody to recognize that you really have potential. Otherwise, you might, you know, there might be some disparity depending on what school you're coming from at an undergraduate level, if you want to go into physics in graduate school. Once you're in graduate school, the quality of your work starts to matter a whole lot more than where you're going to graduate school. Okay, and that actually starts to just become true more and more. It becomes more of a meritocracy than you might think as you get older. So I would say, you know, there's still a correlation even in graduate school, whether it's a powerhouse or a lesser known place. But even by that point, a lot of it is actually more that, you know, the powerhouses actually actively look around for people who are flagging individuals who look like they're very promising.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, look, I think the reality is that it's easier if you're, you know, probably the odds are somewhat in your favor if you're going to MIT or Harvard as an undergrad or as a graduate student. But it's not the only way by any means. I know plenty of people, you know, there were plenty of people in my class at Harvard who went to schools that, you know, that other academics have heard of, but people on the street certainly haven't. Plenty of, so, you know, some people from state schools. A lot of people from state school grad schools go on to be physicists. It's not as, the one thing I'll say though is it is really important to make sure for graduate school that you go to a place that has, you know, has advisors that you can work with, that have, you know, that have done good work and are good mentors. Because that mentorship aspect is really crucial in grad school. And also, yeah, get to know people. You know, get to know people if you want to do physics, get to know physicists in your department. Talk with them, you know, earn their respect and learn from them. And then they will write you good letters for graduate school. Which, I mean, I also know plenty of people from MIT that did really well in their classes, were really smart, and didn't do well in graduate school applications, just because they didn't have the sort of, you know, the professors vouching for their commitment and their, well, I don't know why.
Well, I mean.
So I shouldn't say, but.
I really want to stress this though, because when both of us were in graduate school, the people coming in were from all over the place. And I mean all different kinds of schools, but they all have one thing in common, as I sort of later started to learn, you know, you'll get to know them and talk with them, which is that at some point, and this was true for us, at probably both of us as well, even though it was more of a kind of magnet school for physics, is that, you know, somebody noted, hey, this person's really good, really has potential, and they vouched for them behind the scenes. And that's actually, I mean, you know, it sounds like some sort of, you know, secretive club behind the scenes, but that's kind of how the world works, because you can't always tell if people are going to sort of be good. So you have to rely on the judgment of others. And you know, I think that's the stage at which it really started to equalize. So I wouldn't worry too much about what school you go to or whether or not it's a magnet in physics. I think the main thing is to just do really well at whatever you're trying to do. People around you will notice. It's not as common as you would think. Sort of quality stands out, trust me.
So what is your viewpoint on the conflicts between science and religion?
I don't think there's a conflict. I think there's a conflict between when science overreaches, there's a conflict with religion. When religion overreaches, there's a conflict with science. That's my view of it. Obviously, there's some things that 1,000 years ago nobody thought it was religion overreaching to take Genesis very seriously, and I would call that religion overreaching into something that, you know, what does the meaning of our life and any divine being in the world have to, you know? Well, let me put it this way. Why would a God need to tell a bunch of people a thousand years ago a story about where humanity came from? I mean, where the world came from? Isn't it more likely that those people would intermingle it with their own, you know, worldview and other oral traditions? So I don't actually see a conflict between it, because really. The questions that, but that's because I think the purview of religion is actually kind of limited to morality and spirituality, not to cosmology, not to where humanity came from. That's an area that religion has tried to cover, that most major religions have tried to answer the question, where did we come from? I think that's normal. Most people want to answer those questions. But I think that is a question that to me should be left to science. But I mean, it's a matter of drawing lines. For me, there's
Well, why, I mean, they're so different. I mean, what kind of comparison or, I mean, do you have a specific question in mind, or are you just looking for sort of general,
about the creation of the universe?
Clearly nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Scientists or religious people don't know about the creation of the universe, in my entirely immodest opinion.
I mean, I could try to tell you what I think is more likely, but at the end of the day, it does boil down to that.
Oh yeah, there was this Stephen Hawking special about how his theories of the beginning of the universe mean that we don't need a God. Complete overreaching of science. I mean, the beginning of the universe is confusing to science. It probably always will be. The fact that we can make mathematical models of it is pretty cool. But making a mathematical model of something and understanding the deep whys of it are completely different things. You know, why is there a universe? Science, like why in the sort of, you know, sense that we usually use the word why, science is never going to answer that. What are the mathematical equations that describe the beginning of the universe? Religion is never going to answer that. So to me, they're just very, very different in the kinds of questions that they try to help us answer. Yeah.
In your opinion, of the research being done to date, what do you think is the most promising?
Broadly speaking, or here?
Just anything, or mostly like in the field of physics, but it's very.
So Feynman has this great story about how a lot of research is like picking a lock, where, you know, you're going, and you go from not having picked the lock to picking the lock, and it's picked, and you're done. And you don't know in between how promising things are. So I think within a specific field, I can talk about what research I think is more within my field, what research I think is more, like what specific kinds of papers I think are more likely to lead to progress than others. But if you ask about, like, what's going to lead to progress, string theory or condensed matter theory or the LHC, I don't know. They're all going to lead, either all of them have the possibility to lead ultimately to not much, any particular problem. Any of them has the potential to be.
Well, now is a particularly weird time. I mean, that question, what do you think the most promising line of research is? We ask this every day, okay? We sit around at lunch and talk about this. I mean, it's not, because now
but
it's
in the micro sense.
In the micro sense, I mean, so I mean, broadly speaking, there are certainly areas that are making more progress than others, but within fundamental physics, I think it's a big open question. And actually right now, we have all this new experimental data coming in. For a long time, people, I think, were expecting this data to be very decisive, potentially to usher in a whole new era. It's very confusing right now. It's not clear what sort of thought that people had started 20 years ago is going to explode into the right direction of research.
Yeah.
There's some fun things going on.
There's also just different, you know, different values that different kinds of physics have. I mean, I think the majority of condensed matter physics is going to teach us a lot about different kinds of materials that you can make. And it's almost becoming this really awesome new branch of engineering, as far as I understand it, and I'm not an expert, where you can really dream up these wacky quantum materials, and it's amazing, but that's not teaching us about, like, what are the building blocks of the universe the way something like string theory or particle physics or cosmology does. They're just different types of questions. Within the sort of fundamental physics rubric, personally, I think the most useful thing to do right now, which is why I'm trying to do a little tiny piece of it, is probably trying to think of new ways of doing experiments, new ways of you know. I mean, high-energy colliders are awesome. I'm very excited about the LHC. But it's not clear. There might be one, maybe even two more steps beyond that. And then it's kind of a technology that, for a long time at least, will have reached its limit. So thinking about, like, what are totally new directions to explore, new kinds of experiments to do? Can you do experiments with write in different ways that test that that tests something fundamental? Can you use really highly entangled systems? And just figuring out what are the experimental questions that we should be asking that we haven't been asking for the last 20 years, either because we didn't think of them because we were so sure of our framework of quantum field theory, or just because we have new technologies now that we didn't back then. That to me, I think, is one of the few things that right now has the potential to be really explosive in the sense of changing how fundamental physics is done 20 years from now. And then, of course, the other thing is if there was a discovery at the LHC, that would also be...
Well, but going beyond energy colliders, though,
just
in case you don't know, we've never actually seen gravity waves. I mean, we've been talking about them for 100 years, but we've never actually seen them. That could just, in a heartbeat, change everything. And there's an experiment that should be sensitive enough to see them from various sources that, for example, TI is getting involved in. Even though maybe not everybody would bet that could be the most promising line of research, that's an example of where something could pop up and just absolutely change the field. So just to go back to the left, the uncertainty.
Yeah.
Just going off of that gravity waste question you were saying there, how long do you guys wait until you finally say that, okay, maybe this doesn't exist, maybe it just doesn't happen? Because, if gravity waves are not found, I've heard general relativity.
If LIGO doesn't find gravity waves, everybody will say that LIGO is just full of it. Okay, so you'll do another experiment.
Right, and in the case of LIGO, there's actually going to be, the expectation was anywhere between 0.05 and 4 gravity wave signals in the lifetime of the experiment. So not seeing anything doesn't rule anything out.
Yeah. So you'll do another
they
more
don't
powerful
see
version
it.
Of the experiment.
Yeah.
If that doesn't happen.
They wouldn't give up and just keeps going.
Absolutely.
Well, although something like gravity waves, then there's advanced LIGO that's coming online soon. And there's really an expectation that advanced LIGO should see several events within a year. And probably if they saw nothing, my first reaction would be, these advanced LIGO people seem to know what they're doing, but maybe maybe there's some noise in their detector that's precisely canceling the gravity waves, and they're still there. Or maybe the sources are just a lot more rare than we thought. And then if the next generation after that didn't see anything, then we'd have to start thinking, what if there are no gravity waves? How could that possibly be?
The whole conversation about fundamental physics is just very different from that point on. That's why I say, right now is a weird time, because there are these very fundamental things that we've never actually tested that we're going to start to test. It's really fundamental. And then there's things that we have extremely high precision tests of the standard model that in many respects we might just be finishing off with the discovery of the Higgs. That might be it. We have a standard model and we're done. And then it's a question of really understanding better where it comes from. Or who knows, maybe that won't pan out. Maybe the LHC any day will announce some anomaly that where we can't quite understand what the origin of it is. Or any of the dark matter experiments looking for dark matter in reverse detector. And so on and so forth. So we're at this point where anybody could, an example is I hate to bring it up, but the OPERA result on the faster than light neutrino. Now, this is an example where almost everybody said they're full of it, messed up cables, they really should just check them, their work, and indeed they have a problem. But everything does change. If a result like that comes along and then it stands up. And we're ripe for that precisely because we've got so many experiments happening right now. But a lot of us, as I was mentioning, are worried about what happens after that. And that's what that has to do with trying to find new ways to go about building experiments.
Okay. As a theoretical physicist researcher, how do you choose your research methodology? And as well, how do you conceptualize your variable?
How do you conceptualize what?
Your variable. And also, what other mechanism do you use to collect your data other than going to the lab and also using your computer and the library, if there are? Three questions.
Yeah.
So what aside from colliders do we use to collect data? That question.
Yeah.
Labs, computers. What are the sources?
Yeah.
So you mentioned labs, computers, libraries. I think that pretty much covers it, right? Well,
as theorists,
and people.
Sometimes as a theorist, though, you feel like your own data collector because I kept alluding to, we come in, we talk for a while and we'll do some calculation, but usually the whole point of that calculation, it's like you're an experimentalist, but the laboratory is this little mathematical playground, and you're trying. I mean, it's weird. It's like it's a black box. You've got some mathematical machinery. You don't quite know how it fits together. And, you know, you give some inputs. You see what the outputs are. You try to figure out what's going on inside. So in a way, as a theorist, I would say you're collecting data when you sit down every day to sort of do, you know, little test calculations to see what's going on. So that's one way to do it. Maybe that doesn't speak to your...
Go ahead.
This might be a little bit of a ridiculous question, but I was talking to my mentor about it earlier. But if the LHC was able to get up to high enough energies that they could create small black holes that would just evaporate, could they be able to potentially use those for quantum gravity experiments?
In principle, well, in controlled experiments would be difficult because if you produce small black holes at the LHC, they evaporate so quickly that you can't actually manipulate them. You could try to learn about the process through which black holes evaporate by studying what comes out. And it's controlled only in the sense that you've got this huge machine that can produce it every once in a while.
Yeah, so small black holes are the most quantum black holes. They're also the least black hole-y black holes.
Yeah, they're not really black.
Because they're very quantum. So I don't know. I mean, that makes them, on one hand, great for quantum gravity. On the other hand, I don't know how useful, if we have great theories of quantum gravity, I think they would be useful for testing those theories, like precision predictions of the theories. But in terms of trying to get a sort of big conceptual knock on the head of how something works, probably not, just because they behave a lot. The small black holes really behave a lot like some new particle. Kind of boring.
They would be pretty crazy particles, though.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, when you make a small black hole, the thing in the process of evaporating, you expect it to start basically producing all the particles that it can in the standard model in its final burst. So it'd be like a little bomb going off in the collider.
So if you could change all the laws of nature, how would you like the universe to be?
Well, see, I've had to go into anthropics on this one. The laws of nature are very kind to us. Most ways of changing them would kill all possibilities of having chemistry, macroscopic people that don't turn into black holes, all that good stuff. And still have, are larger enough than a molecule that we can have brains. So if the smallest thing that didn't turn into a black hole was like 5 molecules long, it couldn't do very much thinking. So, but if I could get around that problem and figure out a way to change the universe, the laws of nature, I think I'd want a bigger HBAR. I think I'd like to really get have HBAR big so that I can understand quantum mechanics on an intuitive level and really know what it's like to live in a quantum world. but yeah, that would probably also wreak havoc on my existence, so I'm a little reluctant to go there.
Okay, so we're down to the last few minutes, so maybe just a few more questions.
Okay, if you could bring any great physicist or scientist back to
life,
or would you
want
to talk to
Faraday?
Sorry?
Faraday.
We're both obsessed with Michael Faraday. Although, is he the person we want to bring back
to? Well, it depends on what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
I just want to talk to him.
I just think he's awesome, so
yeah.
I want to talk to him for that reason.
We're not the only people who think that. A lot of people at various points would have brought Michael Faraday back to life. They could have.
Is there ever a moment, well, I'm sure there is there any one phenomenon in all of theoretical physics that always comes to your mind, like, why does that happen? There's just that one thing stuck in your mind for so long and you've always been thinking about it and it's never been answered so far. And whenever you're sitting there free or just having lunch and just kind of diverted from your own research that you're on to, does it come back to your mind? Like, why does that happen?
Yeah,
why does something in particular happen?
Yeah. Any one occurrence in the universe, or any one reason for something happening?
Is that for you?
Not yet.
Not yet. Doesn't happen with me yet. There's usually particular things I'm not any particular.
Yeah, if I get very obsessed with a phenomenon or with a problem, I'll usually take that as a sign that I should work on it. And then it doesn't distract me from my work anymore. But there probably should be.
So maybe one more question?
I'm just referring back to when you were saying you were working on your experiment that you had 19-hour days for 2 weeks straight. Do you find, like, in instances like this, do you find that there's like outside pressure to make discoveries, or are you doing this just because it's really exciting and you're in the moment and you might as well kind of feel?
Well.
Right, so that's the case. We were running a short experiment. We had, well, we ended up having 3.5 weeks or so, but originally we thought we'd have 2 weeks on the beam. Right. You know, 2 weeks from the time we were first allowed to go into the hall and move equipment around to the time we were going to get kicked out for somebody else to do the same thing. So basically, I mean, these accelerator labs are expensive enough to run that time is a very valuable commodity. Each experiment gets a little bit, and you don't want to waste any of it.
Keep in mind, people are depending on you.
Yeah.
A lot of people. And it's their experiment, too. And you know, in a way, you know, you sort of get the... You get the honor of sort of making the big decisions, but that you know, we all took that very, very, very seriously. So I would say a certain amount of peer pressure is not a thing.
Well, so I think this was a really interesting session. Let's thank Natalia and Philip again.